Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 251. Today's guest is Chris Quinones, a licensed massage therapist and certified therapy massage and bodywork practitioner. We will be discussing Ayurvedic approaches for women's health. You can find Chris online at www.rasa-yana.com. That's rasa-yana.com. And as always, don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus251. Take a listen. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start by hearing a little bit about you. Tell us about your academic background and training.
Well, in college, I actually was always, let me back up. Even before my undergrad years, I've always been a bit of an anatomy geek and into biology and curious about the natural world around me. Even as a kid growing up in New Hampshire, I was always hiking in the White Mountains or skiing or swimming in the ocean of Maine and, you know, being outside and connected to nature. So in college, I pursued a pre-med major course of study. My path initially was to enroll into medical school. And so after college, I moved to the Boston, Massachusetts area and started working to build my CV and application to med school. And for about 5 years, I worked in Boston for various orthopedic surgeons and vascular surgeons as their medical or research assistant, and then eventually continued on to some orthopedics and sports medicine specializing, which was really my jam, if you will. As a former competitive athlete myself, using the body was something that certainly was important to me in helping people achieve their peak performance. And so for that period of time, I worked as an orthopedic technician and working for different orthopedic surgeons in Boston with lots of knee replacements, hip replacements, osteoarthritis, and scoliosis, and a lot of other kind of degenerative diseases or injuries to soft tissue and bone. And then ultimately, I decided I was not going to go to medical school after having gone through that process of applying and being denied entry. I took some time off to really consider how badly I wanted to do this. And at that point, I was in my early mid-20s and had been very much on the hamster wheel of life in that rush, rush, rush mode. And so what I understand now to be a blessing in disguise, because it really imposed a pause in my life for me to reassess what I truly valued. And I took time off to travel and backpack in Europe as a young single woman and enjoy my free time and my newfound energy. And when I returned from that trip, I knew in my heart that while I have always considered myself to be a healer, that this may not be the right environment for me to be able to do that kind of work. And I didn't know what it was going to look like or if I would, in fact, circle back to allopathic medicine and sports medicine. I just knew that it didn't feel right. And I didn't know what the next steps would be, but I knew that it couldn't be as they were if I was going to honor my true self. This was right around the time I had also started studying yoga and practicing from the Ashtanga yoga system. So what began as a rehabilitative effort for an old sports injury really was the impetus for the beginning of my spiritual practices and journey, which allowed me to extricate myself from the craziness of orthopedics and allopathic medicine, and dive in deep with my yogic practices and studies. And in the meantime, take a variety of temporary jobs and working in higher education and at Berklee College of Music for a number of years while I just kind of figured out what my next move was going to be. And during that time, I eventually came to massage school. And it was a really natural segue, given all of my experience in orthopedics and sports medicine, and as an athlete myself. I am a former competitive martial artist, and now I am also a former ballroom dancer competitively. So I knew I could transfer a lot of those skills and knowledge from anatomy, physiology, kinesiology, pain management. How do we repair tissues in the body and really initiate the body's healing response? For me, my martial art injury allowed me to begin that path by studying yoga. I continued working in higher education for about 10 years while I, quote unquote, figured it out. And that meant going back to massage school and applying a lot of my existing skills with palpation and giving people therapeutic massage, rehabilitative massage. As my yoga study deepened, I was eventually introduced to Ayurveda, this traditional medical system from India. It is a Vedic system, just like yoga. And so yoga was really my segue into this traditional medicine. Fast forward 20 years, more training, more studying, more traveling and backpacking in India and in the US with some of the leading experts in Ayurveda, to eventually become an Ayurvedic body worker as my specialty as a massage therapist. And so I continued my body work career in these natural rejuvenative and detoxifying treatments that are found in this system of Ayurveda. And that began my path along this holistic approach to not just healing, but also living. And the deeper I dived into my personal practice and study, the more passionate I became about sharing this wisdom with other people, and especially women, because I feel like women's health is a big piece of unfinished business in this 21st century here. And we really, I feel, can bring my skill sets and talents to women, which in turn will help heal the world, I believe. And so that was my trajectory from a very Western, limited, but effective intervention kind of system of allopathic medicine to a more holistic and integrative model, where I will also include in my approach to well-being and health all of the lifestyle and behavioral things that need to change in order to support healthy, resilient tissue and health. So that's what I do now. I have a private practice in just outside of Boston in Winchester, Massachusetts, and I help people who are feeling disconnected from their bodies and are in pain. And I take them through a year-long natural self-healing journey where they can develop the tissue resilience and the intuition to age skillfully. And then from there, you can really be the master and mistresses of your life and step into your dharma. What is your purpose? What is your role in this lifetime? And be able to experience greater ease. You know, the more I experienced these kinds of beneficial changes in my personal life, the more I wanted to share them with others. So it really has been a culmination of the last 20, 25 years of study with classical theory, both East and West, and living it and practicing it and putting together all of these skill sets to help women in taking care of themselves and in turn, really taking care of our communities and our planet.
You mentioned our main topic briefly, but we are going to be getting into all of it in depth today. Let's start with a broad overview. What is Ayurveda?
Ayurveda is the traditional medical system of India. It is an ancient system that dates back to an indeterminable amount of time. Scholars have many kind of arguments. It's a scholarly argument as to how old Ayurveda is, but we're talking at least 4,000 to 5,000 years old, that the oldest scripts and texts in Ayurveda, the Vedas, which they come from, are dating back to about 1500 BC. And this is a holistic system that allows us the resources and the intelligence to unlock our self-healing capacity. And that is done through the use of our habit evolution, and the habits of yogis around lifestyle and diet. It is based off of a natural whole foods diet and includes sometimes the use of botanicals, different body work and massage therapies to detoxify the body, to improve the lymphatic health of the person, and also a means for people to understand what kinds of choices in their lives are going to be beneficial or non-beneficial to their unique physiology and mental constitution. And that Ayurveda is based off of these five great elements: space, air, fire, water, and earth. And these elements rule and govern the laws of Mother Nature. Yoga and Ayurveda, being Vedic systems, teach us that we are not separate from nature, that the same elements that exist in the universe and interact with one another to produce cyclical changes like our seasons and our weather patterns, these same elements and cycles exist in our own physiologies. And each person has a unique makeup of these elements. And they're often referred to as the doshas, these energies or forces that exist when various combinations of these elements get together. And Ayurveda offers us kind of like an operating manual, if you will, a user's manual for life itself, everything that is involved and encompassed in that. In fact, the word itself, Ayurveda, you can break into two. There's Ayu or Ayus, A-Y-U, which is Sanskrit for life. And that encompasses everything that makes up life: our body, our mind, our sense organs, and the soul. These are the four components, the four pillars of life, according to Ayurveda. And then the word Veda, V-E-D-A, is Sanskrit for wisdom or body of knowledge or an understanding of. So Ayurveda is an understanding of life itself, an understanding of what is going to bring us health and well-being and be beneficial, and what is going to bring us more suffering in life. And that is what Ayurveda is. So it's a very vast system with a depth and antiquity that is parallel to the yoga tradition. And here in the West, yoga arrived first. And now that yoga has been more integrated into the fabric of daily Western American lives, Ayurveda is now getting its due recognition as part of the same philosophy, Samkhya philosophy, that both yoga and Ayurveda come from. In India, and traditionally, a student would not learn or study yoga without also learning and studying Ayurveda. The two are traditionally taught together, yoga being the system of spirituality and Ayurveda being the system of healing. And the two supporting one another, allowing us to not only extend our life, but also improve the quality of that life. So it's a very broad, but very deep, simple, and complex. How deep the dive is up to the student.
What are the common causes of infertility, according to Ayurveda?
The biggest causes to, or challenges, I'll say, to women's health, to infertility, is the imbalance. It is the stress emergency that is happening, that has been happening for a very long time, that we are not addressing the impact of stress in our daily lives. By not addressing that through our lifestyles, through our diets and behaviors, but lifestyle really is even more important than the diet and what to eat. When you look at holistic systems like Ayurveda, that the problem is the inability for people to keep up and manage stress in their daily lives. And being able to understand the language of Ayurveda being one of opposites. It's a language of dualities, on that either something builds you up and is very nourishing and calming and cooling, very much the feminine archetype, which is referred to as santarpana in Ayurveda, or something is going to be very stimulating and heating and catabolic, breaking down in nature, archetype masculine energy, which in Ayurveda we refer to as apartana or langana. And so we have these building and lightening forces and qualities at hand. And so being able to manage that and manage our hormones within the context of our daily lives, this is where the tissue breakdown begins, and in turn leads to all kinds of health challenges, including infertility or challenges with conceiving.
How can women use and apply Ayurveda's wisdom for healthy hormones and conception?
I think the best way for people to, women especially, to begin with their path of how am I going to really apply this to my life is to start in small steps, to start by scheduling periods of silence in their lives regularly, a chance to rest and have more opportunity and space in their schedules for those building, nourishing practices, for those santarpana kinds of practices, be it eating nourishing foods, reducing the intake of alcohol, favoring spices and herbs that are known to move the blood and lymph, like fresh ginger and turmeric, working with a practitioner. There are various botanicals in the Ayurvedic pantheon that can help move the blood and lymph. Those are important because they remove obstructions and reduce stagnation in the body. And oftentimes, stagnation causes pain. Stagnation causes dis-ease when something is not flowing. That life force energy, or prana, as we say in yoga, can cause a problem. And so emphasizing these kinds of blood-moving spices will be a big benefit in a daily life. Just simply making a nice, maybe spice mix of some ground cumin and some ground fennel seeds and some ground coriander seeds in equal parts, and making a nice simple mix, a digestive mix that's going to help keep the lymph and blood moving and help keep the tissue very strong and resilient. These are just some simple ways to start with reducing the effects of stagnation and addressing some of the stress epidemic that causes this battle between our stress hormones and our sex hormones. And this is where women have really been, I think, and believe, underserved, that we really haven't been given the resources to learn as Westerners how to balance the stress and the sex hormones, that we've become very focused on lists and recipes and exact formulas. And we forget that in order to examine our lives, we have to look at the big picture. And I think that that's a good way to start, with those simple practices of carving out times of silence, using some circulatory warming spices to improve digestion and circulation in the tissues, in the body, and then working with an experienced practitioner to perhaps add some of the botanicals and herbal remedies that are part of the pantheon, and also provide you the resources for some of the stress management that will be necessary to help balance out that gross inequity of stress versus sex hormones that tends to happen in our mid-30s and 40s as adults.
This is likely a very new topic for most listeners, as it is for me. Do you have any recommended reading?
Quite a bit. One of my favorite books about women's health is from one of my teachers, Dr. Claudia Welch. And the title is called Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life. Dr. Welch is also a doctor in traditional Chinese medicine. And so in this book, she combines Ayurveda, traditional Chinese medicine, with allopathic medicine as well. She gives great resources on managing that balance between sex versus stress hormones, how to intelligently go about using and considering bioidentical hormones for those that need it, and really just creating better health overall. That's the first book I would recommend as introduction, if you will, to these systems and to how your body works, because hormones don't work in isolation, in vacuums. And holistic systems like Ayurveda are not going to tell you which herb is great for which symptom. Instead, it's going to tell you what the optimal environment is for all of your hormones to work efficiently. I think I digressed a little bit there, but going back to your question about recommended reading, another great descriptor or book that describes hormonal happenings within one cycle is called Woman in Intimate Geography. This was written by Natalie Angier, A-N-G-I-E-R. It was published by Anchor Books in 2000. And that gives a really great geography of your own relationship to hormones. And I think that starting with those two is great reading.
Hopefully this next question doesn't overlap with what you've already said, but what is the number one practice that women should be doing to improve their fertility challenges, and where exactly do they begin?
I would say two. I know you asked for one, but I will say that number one is to schedule more periods of silence, to reevaluate your schedule. We are overscheduled and not really allowing enough time for the mind, for the body to integrate our experiences and turn that into wisdom. And so scheduling periods of silence would be my number one step. And then kind of tangential to that silence is considering a pranayama practice. Now, pranayama is a big fancy Sanskrit word for managing your life force energy. And for those new to yoga and Ayurveda, you'll most commonly know pranayama as breathing exercises or specific breath exercises. If I can now, I'd love to just lead your listeners through one of these simple exercises right now in just 1 minute, 60 seconds.
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. So this pranayama technique is called Nadi Shodhana, which is balanced breath or alternate nostril breathing. Now, if you're someone with a deviated septum or you have a cold and some congestion, you can do a hands-free version, simply visualizing with your mind the following. I'm going to cue the physical. So what you'll do is you'll take your right hand and you'll form a Vishnu mudra. You'll fold the index and middle finger down to the base of your thumb. And this might feel a little awkward. Your ring finger might still be poking and wanting to fold. Do what's comfortable for you. If that mudra is not acceptable, go ahead and fold the ring finger down to the base of the thumb as well. And then we'll begin here. So sit up nice and tall. in your chair, maybe on the floor or on a cushion, with your legs crossed and your feet planted flat on the floor. You're going to take that thumb and close off the right nostril with it. Collectively, wherever you are in your breath cycle, we're all going to exhale together, emptying the lungs. Collectively, inhale through the left nostril. Close the left nostril with the pinky or ring finger and exhale out the right nostril. Staying here, inhale back through the right. Switch and exhale out the left. Inhale left. Exhale right. Inhale right. Exhale left. Inhale left. Trying to find an equal rhythm between inhales and exhales. Exhale right. Inhale right. And exhale left. Continue on your own as I mind the time.
That was fantastic. I actually just feel more relaxed listening to you do that.
Yeah. With just doing that simple alternating nostril breath, nadi shodhana. And again, if you have congestion or a deviated septum or there's issue and you cannot comfortably breathe through one nostril at a time, simply do a hands-free version. And what this does is it helps balance two main energy pathways that spiral down the spine, the Ida and Pingala channels down the body. In Kundalini yoga, this is reflected as a serpent going up the spine. The image of a serpent coming up a staff or some kind of stick is common in medicine, right? We see this iconography on ambulances and the like. And so this breathing technique balances both the santarpana and the apartana channels, that both nourishing and breaking down, the building and breaking down, the cooling and the warming. So without even knowing the language of Ayurveda or knowing what your individual physiology demands, this technique will balance both main qualities. And in doing that, allow you to find the space and the quiet to get in touch with your own intuition and be able to meet and act upon your needs clearly, quickly, confidently, effectively.
You mentioned herbs a little bit earlier. Does Ayurveda recommend certain herbs for infertility? And if so, what are they and how are they taken?
I will say that when someone is choosing to work with herbs, that you do so under the guidance of an Ayurvedic practitioner. That while these plants are available over the counter and you can get them online, there are potential interactions with medications. And so do be sure, any of you listening now, if you're interested in Ayurveda, then you can find a practitioner to help you use these plants intelligently. They're not for everybody. One of them is Manjista. Manjista is one of those blood cleaners, the lymph movers. I mentioned some culinary spices earlier. This is more of a therapeutic botanical that a practitioner may recommend. Ashwagandha is a very commonly now known adaptogenic herb amongst the yogis anyway, those who might already be on the yogic path. This is a wonderful adaptogenic herb for adrenal fatigue, which often accompanies this stress epidemic and hormone imbalance. Shatavari is another herb that is wonderful for supporting women's reproductive tissue. In fact, if my memory serves me correctly, the translation of Shatavari in Sanskrit means she with 1,000 husbands. And so it's a wonderful herb for the right person. Now, of course, again, there are drug interactions and contraindications to these botanicals. Just because they are natural and plants don't mean they are not powerful. So those are the ones that come to my mind at the forefront right now. There are many others, but for now, those are some of the most common ones that an Ayurvedic practitioner is going to use to get that circulation and break up the stagnation that often accompanies our overscheduled lives.
What are the three pillars of health according to Ayurveda?
The three pillars of health are our nourishment, ahara. Now, this extends beyond our food and what we put on our plate and goes into what we feed our sense organs. What are we feeding our eyes in our entertainment? What are we feeding our ears? What are we feeling on our and putting on our skin? It's very sense organ committed, this practice. So ahara, nourishment, how are we feeding the tissues of our body is the first pillar. Nidra, or sleep, is the second pillar. How are we able to manage our stress, respond to the stress of our daily lives in order to consistently get deep restorative sleep? This is an epidemic right now that we are a sleep deprived nation, and that has detrimental effects to the quality of tissue that the body can build. And if we're not sleeping well, then our tissues are not well. We're not detoxifying well. We're not rebuilding and rejuvenating the tissues, which are processes that happen when we sleep. So sleep is the second pillar in health, according to Ayurveda. The third pillar is what the yogis refer to as brahmacharya, which classically translates to sexual abstinence. But more contemporary application is energy management, a judicious use of our sexual energy. These are the three pillars of health. And Ayurveda says, you master these, you focus on these, and that will give you the resources for healthy, thriving health.
Does Ayurveda interfere with fertility treatments? Why or why not?
It does not. It does not interfere with fertility treatments or any other kind of approaches, really, because it is a nature-based system. The effects are powerful, but the approach is very gentle. And so it's very complementary for those who are using an integrated health model. It can be used in conjunction with those who are going through IVF. I have several clients who see me who are in IVF, and they see me for some of the traditional Ayurvedic body work. Ayurvedic massage, like Abhyanga, is the classic body work treatment that a lot of women experiencing infertility and going through that process to parenthood benefit from. It's very gentle. And you can use Ayurveda with acupuncture, with your chiropractic appointments, with your yoga therapist, because it really is about applying habit transformation and not relying on anything outside of you, because the healing potential comes from within you.
How does someone find an Ayurvedic practitioner?
I recommend, if you don't know someone personally or in your local yoga communities, that's where you'll be more likely to find an Ayurvedic resource, since these are systems that classically were always taught together. But if you're not part of a yoga community, you're seen and you're just interested in natural healing through Ayurveda, I recommend the National Ayurvedic Medical Association, which is in the U.S. and it's now 20 years old. And you can go to their website at Nama Ayurveda. That's NamaAyurveda.org and do a search for a provider there. And that's where I recommend people go if they don't know someone or can't get a personal referral to a practitioner in your area to assure that they are well trained and that they have been vetted to some extent. The profession of Ayurveda is still being regulated here in the West. We're still figuring out how to make it become a licensed profession, which legislation is currently in the process for right now. But practicing Ayurveda in the US is a bit limited for those Ayurvedic physicians. So there are three levels of Ayurvedic professionals that one can work with here in the United States. One of them is an Ayurvedic health counselor. This is what I am. I've received well over 600 hours of training in how to counsel people around their diet and lifestyle using this system and philosophy. There's an Ayurvedic practitioner who has the same training as a health counselor, plus an additional amount of training in the botanicals. Now, health counselors also are trained in a certain amount of botanicals, usually around a dozen or so. A practitioner has a wider scope of those plants. And the third level of professional Ayurvedic practitioner in the US is an Ayurvedic physician. And an Ayurvedic physician goes through extensive medical training in India on par with medical school here in the US for 5 years. And because Ayurveda here in the West is not yet a licensed profession, true Ayurvedic physicians are not yet able to practice Ayurveda here in the US as they would in India. Here in the West, only a medical doctor can diagnose and give treatment. So that is still in process. But by having resources like the Medical Association, you can rest assured that you are seeing someone who has met certain qualifications and established training and guideline for staying safe.
We've talked about some of the things to do, but what are common mistakes you see women struggling with infertility make, and what recommendations do you have to prevent those mistakes?
The most common mistakes I see women with infertility making is focusing too much on the food. I think in generally we do this here. Not getting too rigid about anything, whether it's food, exercise, what the latest and greatest supplement or resource may be for you to use in your goals. I think slowing down is something that needs to happen. So overscheduling is the second most common mistake I see women making with regard to their fertility efforts. It's simply just doing too much. Again, needing to schedule more times of silence, more times to be and not do. That is, I think, the biggest mistake that we make in general as Westerners approaching our health. We get a little too myopic and a little too rigid and a little too specific on one thing or one list and forget our own intelligence and wisdom of knowing in our own hearts, in our intuition, what is best for us. But if we do not slow down and we do not create the space in order to develop those deep listening skills, then it's not likely to change. Identifying what your values are helps in managing your time, establishing and maintaining firm boundaries in your relationships, so that you really can have more of the building qualities. You can have more of that santarpana in your life in order to sustain not only your life, but create a new one.
I want to come back to food in just a minute here, but you've mentioned silence a couple of different times, and I'm hoping you can clarify, do you mean literal silence, or can that include white noise?
Yeah, you know, I think it'll be a spectrum, because everyone is going to do what they can with what they've got in the time that they have. So that's my first piece of advice, is don't think if you have no experience with contemplative practices, you're going to easily be able to sit on a meditation cushion still and quiet for 15 minutes a day, right? So I think that starting small in small steps is key. And with regard to silence, scheduling times where literally you are not taking in more sensory information. So silencing the phone, staying off of your electronics, literally creating silence, no music, maybe engaging in other activities like journaling or taking a walk outside with nature. These would be moments of silence. You could practice simply by taking your meals in silence, one meal a day. Pick one meal a day that you're going to eat in complete silence. You're not going to chat with your colleagues and your family. You're not going to be checking your email. You're not going to be watching TV or having news go on in the background while you're eating your dinner. You're just going to simply put all your attention on your food and digesting it well. Start there.
At the risk of sounding ridiculous, I feel like this is a really hard task, especially for people with infertility.
Yeah, and I don't mean to oversimplify it. But the truth of the matter is, after doing this for over 20 years and working with hundreds of women, I see the same things over and over again. What I'm seeing is this overscheduling, overstretching, and it's costing us. We are literally just burning through our life force energy. And without holding space for that balancing force of building, we just are always going to be in a state of breaking down. And that's why community is important. That's why having a teacher or a coach is important, because you need someone to help hold the space for you. These practices are not easy. Habits are habits because they've been around for a long time. And so when you work in groups, when you work with a teacher, someone who's more experienced, someone who's further down the path, then you're held more accountable. Then you're able to identify blind spots more quickly, because we've all got them. And you're able to get to the results more quickly. And so chances are, if you've been going at this on your own for a while and you're still struggling and floundering, you need to find a teacher or a practitioner or a group or a coach or an accountability buddy. Use the power of Sangha. You know, in Hindu mythology, there are stories of even the gods asking for help from Lord Shiva, that we can't create difficult change on our own, or it's very difficult to do. And because of that, reaching out to someone, reaching out to an experienced practitioner who can guide you through that journey and process in a way that's going to keep you safe, keep you motivated, and keep you in love with you and all of the light and beauty that resides there, no matter what your path parenthood may be. In the end, these kinds of practices are what are going to allow you that spiritual and emotional development for parenthood, for relationship. And that's where I recommend people start, with Sangha, with community, and with an experienced practitioner to keep you safe.
What kind of food or diet does Ayurveda recommend for infertility?
A seasonal one. One that's going to favor the sweet, sour, and salty tastes. Now, when I say sweet, I mean naturally occurring sweet foods. Fruits, dates, figs, maple syrup, honey, these kinds of natural sweeteners in life. Salt would be in the form of mineral salt, your Himalayan rock salt, or your sea vegetables, kelp, nori. It's wonderful to just take a sheet of nori and just crumble that into whatever soup you're having. It's a great way to hit your diet with some much needed salt and mineral for building healthy, strong, resilient tissue. And the sour taste. The sour taste would be your citrus fruits, your lemons, your limes, your grapefruits, your fermented foods. So your kombucha, your kimchi, your fermented pickled vegetables. These are heating in effect once they've been digested. And as a result of that heat, they're very circulatory. And so they circulate the blood and lymph, which often gets obstructed or flowing in the wrong direction when we have poor quality diet and habits. So that's where I would recommend someone begin.
You've mentioned yoga a couple of times. How might listeners' yoga practices need to change?
Great question. When we're talking about conception, we want to be framing our lifestyle, our habits around that lunar cooling, building, calming archetype. And so with a yoga asana practice, your practice will be benefited from a very slow pace. That doesn't mean you cannot do a sun salutation, but it might mean that instead of jumping back or through your chaturangas, as an ashtanga, maybe an advanced ashtangi yoga practitioner may do, that you simply step back or step forward from plank. This would be a nice way to add a softening quality, a nourishing, calming quality to your asana practice. Also favoring poses like seated twists, squats, favoring lunges, things in the lower body to help ground that energy, that flow of prana and life force energy in that downward direction, which we need. We need in order for the body to feel safe and to hold on to the fetus until it's time for delivery. Partner yoga is a wonderful way to connect and deepen intimacy for those along their path to parenthood. The pranayama exercise, Nadi Shodhana, I mentioned earlier, that alternate nostril breathing is one aspect of a yoga practice. And also the more spiritual practices in yoga, the principles of tapas, meaning friction or heat. It's the friction that's produced when we are changing our habits. It's when a new habit's rubbing up against an old habit. That is what creates transformation. So the principle of tapas, making an effort to do or change something, requires a little bit of work, a little bit of heat, a little bit of friction. Practicing a principle of svadhyaya, self-observation, observing yourself in action. Are you, in fact, making choices that are in line with what you value? Brené Brown is one of my heroes. She has a wonderful resource on her website around values. I think it's from her book, Dare to Lead, where you can go through a list of over 100 set values and identify which are the ones that are most important to you, and then observe yourself in action. And then finally, the principle of Ishvara Pranidhana, which is one of the yamas in the system of yoga, which is non-attachment, releasing attachment to a given or particular result, that the fruit comes from the work itself, the discipline that is cultivated in these practices to ease the mind, to nourish the body. These are principles where a yoga practice can really focus in on, aside from the physical postures of strengthening the tissues and getting the lymph and blood moving and intelligently working that life force energy through pranayama techniques. So that's where a yoga practice can change. It'd be a very slow or restorative style yoga and focusing on the lower body, the lunges, the squats, some seated twists are great for breaking up stagnation in the pelvis and creating more flow, more nourishment, more life itself.
If a listener's partner isn't into holistic or alternative health approaches, how can she include them in her plan?
Ayurveda looks to everything in life according to these elements. And each person has a unique makeup of these elements. And so these three forces, these doshas, by understanding their inherent qualities, you'll better be able to include your partner by understanding what is dominant in your partner's unique makeup. In order to know that, you can take various dosha questionnaire forms that you can easily find online, any Ayurveda website, including my own. You can fill out a questionnaire form there to determine which of these three forces, these three doshas, are most dominant in you. There's Vata, which is a force of mobility and change. And people who are dominant in this energy force are people who are very excitable. They can easily be flexible and change directions. And often, because they are made up more of space and air elements, will kind of need to be brought down to the earth, back down to the ground sometimes a little bit. So if your partner is someone who behaviorally or psychologically lean more toward that kind of quality, then you're going to want to be very tender with them in your requests and very clear with your requests. So it helps bring them down to the earth and more grounded to be supportive for you. If your partner is more dominant in the Pitta force or energy, Pitta is made out of fire and water elements. And so people with a Pitta constitution tend to generally be more fiery in nature. These tend to be your extroverts, people who are very detail-oriented and very specific. So if your partner is more of that energy, then you might want to hit them with the facts, hit them with data, give them the specifics, because that feeds the fire that is naturally in, that naturally burns brighter for people with that kind of constitution. So if your partner is more of a fiery nature, then you can include them by, again, giving specific requests and recommendations, giving them data as to why this approach you're attempting is what you're attempting. For the third force, Kapha dosha, this is made up of earth and water elements. And the qualities inherent to a Kapha dominant person is that they're naturally going to be very stable people. Emotionally, they're very empathic people. Kapha dominant individuals are often the rocks in their community, where people, they're the ones everyone else goes to for help and advice and support. They're the people who are always steady and solid because they have so much earth in them. And so if your partner is more of that force or that constitution, then you may want to include more people into the plan. Allow for change to happen. Couples tend to be slow to change because they're just so heavy with this earth element in their bodies and in their subtle body, their energetic body as well. So they can be a little slower to change, especially if you're changing your diet or your meal planning and some of your self-care habits, which might mean you're going to bed earlier, which might mean you have less time to hang out with your partner, what I find is that for those who aren't privy or invested in a holistic approach, by explaining to your partner why they're important to you and specifically what they can do to help or at least not harm or hurt by proposing something that may not be beneficial to you. That's another way you could make a request. You know, hey, I'm really trying out this new Ayurvedic lifestyle and diet. I recommend that I eat whole, organic, fresh, seasonal foods that are cooked and not raw. It would be really great if maybe you would not offer to make me a big raw salad for dinner anymore, because it's not really in line with what I'm attempting to do right now. Giving them something, including them into the plan, regardless of what dosha your partner may be, including them in the plan, give them something to do, which is be your support, be your accountability buddy, be part of the plan making. That often helps. So even if they don't personally practice or believe in these philosophies or principles, you might. You might be trying them. And whether or not you believe in them, if you're trying them and you're consistent with them, you will see change and results. And I don't know who can argue with that. I don't know who can argue with feeling better and understanding why these steps or these changes are important to you. That's where I feel partners can still be part of the plan, even if they aren't necessarily already part of a holistic community.
To wrap up the episode today, what words of hope would you offer to women who are looking for a holistic way to approach their infertility?
Soften, 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 soften. That while the desire to become a parent may be strong, do not let that attachment and bring you more suffering. Practice good self-care, schedule regular periods of silence and quiet for reflection, for building, and trust. Trust in the wisdom, in that divine intelligence that resides within you, that if you give your mind and body the proper nourishment, the proper rest, the proper rejuvenation, it will heal itself of anything.
Chris, thank you. Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. Regular listeners of the show know that I struggled during my infertility journey with everything from finding the right clinic to advocating for a protocol customized to my body to allowing infertility to consume my entire existence and everything in between. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side and have interviewed hundreds of other warriors and fertility experts, I've discovered the fastest way to realize your dream of becoming a parent is to get educated, regain hope, build resiliency, learn self-advocacy skills, and partner with someone who's been there. Whether you're an infertility newbie or a seasoned veteran, it would be my honor and privilege to provide, as one client put it, unwavering support with fully engulfing and genuine empathy. If you'd like to learn more or schedule a free 30-minute call to discuss how I can support you during your infertility journey, go to beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.